Hello and welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is I don't have anything that clever. It's Joel.
I think it's time to give up on this particular bit, but yes.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to compare me to Danny Glover in this movie, I am some sort of toxic element that could just seem completely harmless when on first appearance, but the longer you spend with me, the more corruption tends to enter the room.
Yeah.
Also, I got a bunch of old guys that I just bring around everywhere. It's kind of weird.
Yeah. Anyway, so this is a special episode for May. For May. And on the underappreciated Charles Burnett. And we got a guest for this one. It's Zebras in America co-host, producer, composer, Scott Thoreau.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here. I've enjoyed listening to you guys. I just re-listened to the Bamboozled episode to get ready to be on the show. And yeah, Zebras in America with Marcus Penn. We're now in the 120s of our episodes. And we also have an episode talking about this movie, but I stupidly forgot which number it was. Mm-hmm. But hi, Doug.
Joel, have you ever smoked PCP?
No.
Okay. Do you like movies?
Yes.
You don't listen to Zebras in America. Never mind.
No.
That's okay. I don't blame you. Most of my friends don't listen to my podcast. They're like, he's like, if I want to listen to you meander, I'll hang out with you.
I just don't. I don't listen to any podcasts. I only, personally, I find them completely inane. No, I'm just kidding. I listen to a lot of everything. So.
Okay. Anyway,
why are you bringing this up in front of the guest here, Spencer? You're just like, how can I shame Joel?
I just wanted to do a Zebras America intro. Every episode, listen to it.
Next thing you're going to tell Alistair, I don't listen to his stuff.
But okay. Yeah, so when I've been sort of teasing Spencer on the podcast for not having me on the podcast, which is very meta. And then we slowly had a very nice little email correspondence about the film The Souvenir and some other movies that we liked. And he threw some ideas out to be on the show. And To Sleep With Anger is a movie I saw, I think, 2 or 3 years ago with filmmaker Mtume Gant at BAM. And it was just one of those movies that I was like, where have you been all my life? And I understand that, you know, being a Jewish kid from Brooklyn, I was not as connected to Charles Burnett's movies as I would have liked to, and then I got reacquainted. I really loved his movie, His Brother's Wedding, but I didn't know it was directed by him. I saw that before I started making a film podcast. My friend was just like, you have to check out this movie. It just tells this really nice, sad story about, you know, a listless guy trying to reconcile who he wants to be. And Killer of Sheep, obviously, is a cult classic, one of Steven Soderbergh's favorite movies. So I was very excited to talk about this movie with you all today. Nice. And thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you for picking it.
Yes, so I've been aware of Charles Burnett for a couple of years. I think I first heard him on Zebras because, like, no one really talks about him really, like, at all. And I love To Sleep With Anger. Like, it's, to me, nearly a perfect film. And, it's so haunting and just, I'm still trying to process everything that it's trying to, like, just the whole movie, because it's so mysterious and, like, is this yet another, underappreciated black filmmaker that we're talking about? And, Joel, what was
right.
Your,
yeah. I, Oh, I can give you my little log line that I wrote to prepare for this episode.
Shoot.
A visit from a childhood friend to the patriarch of Southern expats living in the suburbs of South Central California changes a family and brings about questions of cultural assimilation versus pluralism by director Charles Burnett, his follow-up to My Brother's Wedding, which was shelved after the festival circuit in 1983 and made available in 2007, which was a follow-up to A Killer of Sheep, his thesis film, which was made in
1978. Joel, were you aware? I'll get to that. But Joel, were you aware of Charles Burnett or this movie before I told you we're doing?
No. The I only became aware of this movie when it became part of the Criterion Collection, and then it's got that really fascinating cover, makes it look like a horror movie, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it has the trappings of, it has this character who changes everyone's lives and has a pseudo-supernatural vibe to it, and that's Danny Glover's character. But it's you know, the best movies that have horrific themes are often not horror movies, I think.
Yeah, like Waiting with Ryan Reynolds. Terrifying.
Yeah. Or like Happiness is like the most horrifying movie I've ever seen, and I never have to see it again.
Hmm. Yep.
Yeah, like Bamboozled to me is a horror movie.
It's totally a horror movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like
Safe.
Yeah, that's another.
Yeah.
I feel like you must have known what you were getting into when you watched it or had previously watched it before, having no idea what I was getting into. This whole thing felt like a fever dream, some sort of Lynchian nightmare, but not. Obviously not David Lynch in the least, but these just I had no conception of how much time was passing. And I know it takes place in Los Angeles, but you couldn't tell. This could be anywhere where there's just this group of people living. And I found it fascinating. I don't think I understood half of what was going on though. I don't know why, you know, people started getting this kind of sickness off of him, if it was supernatural or if he was doing things to people, you know, when the patriarch of the family falls sick in the movie. It's like we saw him the day before and they were kind of like walking the tracks and then having these visions of them, I assume, having put the tracks into place in the first place. But he's, you know, they're both tired, but the patriarch looks exhausted. And then by the time they get home, it's like he's ready to die. And that's what not having seen the movie, that's what I assumed was going to happen. Like how somehow this guy exhausted him spiritually or something, and he's just going to die.
But, right. And it's because it starts. What I like about the movie is the juxtaposition. Like it starts with birth, you know, the matriarch is teaching a Lamaze class, and then it ends with death. Spoiler alert, if you haven't seen this 30-year-old movie, but you know, and so you have these little arcs that are going on, and I think it starts off with the patriarch, he can't find his Toby, which I looked into, which is like an amulet or a talisman or a charm. And he feels that brings him bad luck. And then his buddy, was it Henry or Harry?
Harry.
Harry says that he lost his Toby a long time ago. And there's this, you know, he has these two, the patriarch has two sons play with the, you know, not over the top names of Gabriel and Samuel, and they both have you know, biblical leanings to those two characters. You know, one is trying to be modern and let go of the past and makes fun of the fact that the family still has a chicken coop and has these superstitions. And then the other son who finds all of these things very important. And, you know, I even read this great article by Karen Chandler in 1999 that she found that Burnett was trying to tell a story that would restore values and restore goodwill and fraternity and evaluate masculinity and tradition. And I think that the movie does it in a really well, really smart, thoughtful way. And that his first few movies really do examine family units in different ways. And then some of his later movies are a little strange, but
yeah, going off the biblical thing, this feels similar vaguely to Mother, the Aronofsky movie, where it's playing off a biblical theme, so this is more subtle with the biblical things, and I think it's handles like the biblical stuff a little better, where like this is once it clicked in, like some of the like religious themes, like it became very clear, but wasn't overbearing. It's like it's full of this the patriarch's name is Gideon, which obviously like I don't know if it's just in America, but you know the Gideon Bibles that are in hotels.
Yeah,
and I have a cousin who married a man who's very religious named Gideon, so like I always associate that name with being very, very religious to begin with.
But Gideon is the name of the cat in Pinocchio. Disney's Pinocchio.
It is.
And I'm sorry. There's also a great song called Gideon's Bible by one of the members of the Velvet Underground, John Cale. John Cale has a great song called Gideon's Bible that's quite good. And yeah, I mean, it also goes into like the Baptist tradition, and have you all seen Daughters of the Dust?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, so that movie comes out a year later, 1991. To Sleep with Anger comes with in 1990, and that's another movie that has these families and generations also figuring out what to do with tradition and how much is important and what's not important and what to do and the risk of it. Mm-hmm. And while I don't come from a Southern Black family, I come from a third generation Brooklyn Jewish family, I was still able to relate to a lot of the dynamics, even though it's a very, obviously my life is very different, but I understand this struggle to do you adapt, do you assimilate, is pluralism the right way, does assimilation take away your identity, how do we exist in a society, and how much can we keep and still be ourselves, which I think Daughters of the Dust and To Sleep with Anger deal with really well. What do y'all think?
Yes, for most part, but Daughters of the Dust takes it in a more, approaches it in a more experimental, less clear way, where this isn't the most clear movie either. Like once you pay attention and once it clicks in, I think it's pretty clear for the most part. I mean, it took me a while for it to kick in, but like Daughters of the Dust is definitely more art. Like I don't like to describe myself as art house because it has air pretension, but To Sleep with Anger is the more approachable way to do it, but still is very. I lost my train of thought there.
Yeah, of Burnett's first few movies, it's the first one that I think is just has like a little bit more of a structure. And then from there, he did a bunch of interesting ones. Like, y'all see the glass shield?
No.
So, yeah, he made a police brutality movie and with where they, and they really sold it that, you know, the actor Ice Cube was in it, but he was like, he was a co-star, but mm-hmm. he wasn't. He was like, he was in the movie for maybe 15 minutes mm-hmm. at most. It's really mostly about Michael Boatman and Lori Petty playing cops. And it's an interesting one, you know, not his, you know, and then he also made this pretty good movie that a lot of his movies became TV movies. So there's this TV movie that you can find on YouTube called The Wedding with Halle Berry. That's mm-hmm. about this woman getting married to a white beatnik in the 50s in Martha's Vineyard. And it's pretty good. All of his movies have great music. And then there's he made his most recent cinematic film is about South Africa. It's called Namibia, The Struggle for Liberation. And that one was okay. The strangest one that I watched to get ready for this episode was The Annihilation of Fish, which was a look at mental health amongst two people, a Jamaican expat played by James Earl Jones, who has an imaginary friend that he wrestles with, and he has an unlikely romance with a woman played by Lynn Redgrave, who thinks that the ghost of Puccini is trying to talk to her all the time. And now, yeah, that's the romantic comedy that you probably never thought you were going to watch.
After this, I'm going to see everything, even though there isn't that much, which is not that surprising. Because, like, besides, like, learning about the LA Rebellion group of people, and I guess he's the most successful one of the bunch, because like Julie Dash made the one movie and then got stuck in doing TV, and then Jaume Fanaka kind of faded after a certain point, and I can't think of other ones, but like Charles Burnett seems to be the only one that actually had like a kind of mainstreamish film career, which is kind of unfortunate that only one of them actually, you know, made it through. And although Julie Dash is making another movie pretty soon.
She is. And also, like, if you have to make one movie, if your one movie is Daughters of the Dust.
Yep.
I mean, that's me and my fiance watched that movie at the urging of Marcus, my podcast co-host, and M2 McGant, and we watched it, and then we were just like, oh, this movie captures the importance of familial love and bonding that I had not ever seen before. And when she led this group of young women and girls to make an art project last year, she convinced a bunch of 11 and 13 year olds to watch that movie and then make a short inspired by it about climate change. Mm-hmm. And they were all about it, which I thought was really cool. And there's all this really cool shit connected to Daughters of the Dust. Like the book about Daughters of the Dust was co-written by Bell Hooks and Tony K. Bambara. And the art in the movie is, I think, Kerry James Marshall. There's just all these little things, but I'm sorry, we're not talking about To Sleep with Anger. Great movie about this guy who shows up after 30 years and messes everything up.
And like on the meth, and I guess going with the metaphor, like is he supposed to be like the devil or like some demonic, or like not the devil's saber, or like a demon or something along those lines.
I mean, I definitely wondered about the supernatural element, and even for a moment I wondered if he was even the person he said he was. There was a lot of trickery, and then, you know, he just starts really influencing and sort of getting everybody riled up and upset, and I don't know. So when I'm jumping around, but
that's fine.
When the patriarch gets sick, and his lodge brothers start visiting his wife, and one of my favorite characters in the movie, Okra, he brings her some greens, like as flowers. But he's like, yeah. And is that, do you guys know if that's a thing?
No.
I don't know. Like, my dad from West Virginia and some of his family members, like, have small farms and, like, and garden stuff. But, like, they would give each other their crops if they had extra. But, like, outside of that, I don't know.
Right. Like, if people are like, hey, I really like you, here's some greens from the garden. I was just curious. Because I just texted you the Zebras episode that we did about this movie, and I remember we couldn't figure out whether that was a thing.
Yeah.
Yes, and that, so Zebras in America episode 17. So if you want.
So Joel, like, what did you like about To Sleep with Anger?
Well, it was like masterclass acting from Danny Glover. I mean, he's going, like, after this, I'm just convinced he must be one of the best actors that I've ever seen. I mean, the man, it's funny to me, in the 90s that they kept casting him as like this over 50-year-old person. And he's like in his mid 40s. I guess that's not that much of a leap, but I think in the first Lethal Weapon, they're like celebrating his 50th birthday. Hmm. And in the movie, every time he opens his mouth, you know, there's so much of this, so much acting in just the way he's expressing anything he's saying, like whether he's trying to be purposely nice in a like overly sugar-coated way to people he wants to be on the good side of, and then there are parts where he says things that are just like so full of hidden power and negativity, and you know, it could be just like him telling a story. But besides, when he's speaking, he does all this acting with his face that is just so mind blowing to me. Like just a change of expression or just a casual lift of, you know, one side of his mouth or something like that, and I'm like, who else has that much ability to just act like that? Because that's not like theater acting. Like, I think a lot of people, and I'm sure Danny Glover has, you know, gone into the theater, done theater acting and film acting, but you have to have like a awareness of how the camera is going to be reading exactly, you know, with the position of where it is at your face to be like, I know if I do this, people are going to think, oh, he's thinking this or something like that. And it's astonishing in this movie.
Also, because this movie could have been a stage play.
For sure. Yeah.
With a little bit of, if you just change the timelines a little bit, but it works like a play. It has the arc of a play. And that was actually thinking, I was thinking of his performance in a movie I have very complex thoughts about, Manderley, which is blocked like a play.
Yeah, I don't.
Lars von Trier was making was working on making a trilogy about this one character in America. And the first one was, I think, Dogville, where and they made a sequel where the actress in the first one couldn't be in the second one. And this one was so Lars von Trier was trying to handle the concept of race and slavery in, you know, and I don't know if he was really the guy that should have been doing that. And it's a weird movie.
Yeah.
It's a weird movie, but the performances in it are very good. What do you think of that movie, Spencer?
I haven't seen that Lars one yet, but I'm always interested.
You're a big Lars head, Spencer. You should see it.
I will eventually. I'm, you know, he's a shitty person, but that's his persona, or maybe it's a real thing. I'm not sure anymore. I mean, I like Dancing in the Dark a whole lot, but Joel, I know you don't.
I understand that people like that movie. I know people that I like and respect. Not you, Spencer, but other people that like that movie.
Okay. Wow, y'all be throwing each other some shade. Dark. It's dark outside, but y'all are sunning each other and shit.
Only I do the shade on this show.
I see.
That sounds like the most interesting Lars von Trier movie I've heard of so far, Manderley.
He was working on this idea of USA films. So the first one was Dogville with Nicole Kidman, and then she couldn't play. She, for whatever reason, she couldn't be in the second one. So for Manderley, it was Bryce Dallas Howard. Dancer in the Dark is one of those movies where I think it's brilliant. I think musical films have so much opportunity in them to be really outrageous or interesting and fun. That movie was not fun, but you know, I went to see that movie in the theaters with my friend. We worked at a record store together, and he was a very tough guy, and he made me leave the theater alone because he didn't want me to know that he was crying his ass off.
Because
also we loved her music so much that it was just so difficult to see her in pain. And I actually recently, Breaking the Waves has been turned into a neo-modernist opera.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, and I actually went to see it because I'm interested in English, in opera that's in English. And I saw it at NYU Skirball Center like 2 or 3 years ago. And it works as an opera, obviously, but it wasn't for me. I would love to see a stage adaptation of To Sleep With Anger. I think it could be done really, really well.
But I don't know, like, who could play Harry besides, like, Danny Glover, because he's so perfect. Like, it's so perfect to the point where I don't know who could fill in that part.
I think that DJ Qualls probably gonna pull. Okay. I you know, give him a chance.
All right, whatever you say.
Okay, that's your vibe. You got like a edgy, funny vibe. I like it.
I just like to razz Spencer whenever I can, and you know, it's he keeps setting up the softballs. So you know, sometimes I like to talk about movies.
Right.
Yeah, sometimes. But
I think Coleman Domingo could possibly do it, but he's a little young. But
I also think Delroy Lindo could.
Oh man, I mean, of course he could. But Delroy Lindo could do anything.
Yeah.
Delroy Lindo could play Abraham Lincoln.
Oh yeah, I bet that'd be pretty good. But outside of Dan Glover's movie, the performances were all pretty much great to amazing, especially seeing Vanetta McGee as the pregnant wife of Gabriel. She's the, and of course she's playing a mom, and she's the mom in He Got Game and She Hate Me, Malcolm X, a whole bunch of Spike movies. She plays the mom, so that's her thing. But like, she actually gets more to do in this movie, and it's nice to see, like, oh, it's I've never seen her with like a part like quite like this yet. Because, like, Spike never, except for, like, a Strangle Fever. But outside of that, like, Spike never really gives her too much to do in anything.
Right. Like, the actors all get celebrated in every single family unit. Like, you really get to know them, whether it be the neighbor trying to learn how to play his instrument throughout the movie, to the children, to all the different generations of this family and how they exist, but also when y'all said Delroy Lindo, that made me think of that terrible movie Pros and Cons with Larry Miller and Tommy Davidson that used to be on HBO at like 2 a.m. every night.
Never heard of that one either.
It's really bad. I don't recommend it.
That's too bad. I like Larry Miller.
Yeah.
There's other things to watch of his.
I guess.
Yeah.
I also thought Richard Brooks's performance as one of the sons was really well done. You know, he played Jubal early in the series finale of Firefly, that, you know, the Western show by Joss Whedon that somehow got co-opted by libertarians as like the film about the show about libertarianism, but I just thought it was a pretty good show. And he played this sort of like Boba Fett analog, but he played it really awesome, and I would have looked forward to seeing that. And he plays this angry son in this movie really well, I thought, who was always mad with his brother and everybody. He's mad at everybody. Except for Harry, who takes him under his wing, and you could say puts him under a spell.
Yeah, kind of like, because like there's like this movie's full of metaphors, and I was reading Letterboxd reviews of it, and Entume is brought up like it's just filled with all these like hidden metaphors and super on the nose metaphors, and like one of the ones that really clicked with me the second time through was the chicken coop, because in the beginning there's a shot of chicken coop and it's closed and you see people like taking care of it, but by the end of the movie it's open and unkempt and like no one's taking care of it, and it's just like if you pay attention, like you will notice all these, like it's just so layered, and like every other scene or like every scene just has some either a verbal metaphor or a visual metaphor or like some character relationship metaphor that's like that is built into the script, and it's just kind of like it's just amazing how structured and layered everything is. But if it's so free flowing in a way like you can just not notice it and still appreciate everything.
Yeah, I like how effortless but careful and purposeful the sets are, the furniture, the items, the customs, the idiosyncrasies of the characters do feel really deliberate and purposeful, but isn't a distraction or a glitter as like Wes Anderson or something.
Yeah.
Where you're like forced to take in all of this background noise. Where this isn't a noise, it's like a lullaby or something.
Yeah. Let's see. But like the one that really stuck out, something that really stuck out to me was the opening with the Gideon in the white suit, and he's on fire, and like the fruit is on fire, and it just feels like a living painting. And I'm trying to figure out like what it means. Like the obvious answer probably is he's in hell, and the cross on fire is like a foreshadowing, like the his little farm in the backyard going bad and getting ruined. Maybe it's foreshadowing, maybe not. But like it, but this opening is like it's so surreal and powerful, and it's like it's pretty haunting. Like, the whole movie's haunting, but that opening is just a real indicator. Like,
oh yeah,
okay, this is something special.
It sets a tone that follows through.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, and it goes from a shot of his shoes on fire to him barefoot in the sun falling asleep. So it could also just be like, is he dreaming? Was that a vision? And it's just never answered. And it's just one of the mysteries of the film that I love. It's like it gives you so much stuff to just to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I just love movies that leave you pondering and not giving you too much, you know, just allowing you to be and figure out, yeah, to figure out what's going on and make your own assumptions. Like, yeah, is this a supernatural film, or is it just very illusional? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And, that's something that really catches me with it. And I really like the way it's filmed. I like the contrasts of colors and outfits and use of place. I definitely feel like place is really part of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, especially because they're about these people who came all the way to California from, you know, working in railroads in the South and going through all of these different significant cultural turning points.
So
I'm sorry, I feel like I'm barking your ears off.
Oh, no, it's fine. Going with, like, the whole biblical metaphors, do you guys think that Gabriel and Samuel are also supposed to be kind of an analog of Cain and Abel? Potentially, especially with that, when they try to kill each other.
Especially with what happens towards the end, yeah, that's a good call.
I think they're supposed to be allusions of Gabriel and Samuel, like their namesakes in the Bible, you know. We're like, I mean, that's what I read into it, and that's what I also noticed in I read this. You know, I read this article from this literary magazine. The nice thing, I'm in grad school for social work, but the nice thing about being in grad school is having access to literary journals and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I read this really great article in Black Camera magazine by Amy Corbin called Charles Burnett's Aesthetics, My Brother's Wedding is a Bridge Between Killer of Sheep and To Sleep with Anger, and that definitely talks about the biblical stuff. And in an article that I talked about earlier that talks about masculinity in the film and tradition, it also makes the allegories of this spiritual dilemma. And yeah. So yeah, I think that is because. So I think the illusions are certainly on purpose.
It does feel on purpose, and it's just like other stuff I'm trying to process. Like, is a garden supposed to be me with the Garden of Eden, or maybe it's going too far? I don't know, because like at some point I saw Harry as a devil, basically. Just like choosing to appear. Well,
can we talk about a specific scene?
Yeah.
The scene where he's at the younger son's house, and the younger son's wife is just like serving him and all his friends food and like just that's all she's doing, like literally like dishing out food, like to the point where she's it seems like they haven't even eaten anything and she's already got the cake out. She's like cutting a slice and just like dumping it on their plate. Like, what is going on?
It does. That scene does get like absurdly this uncomfortable and surreal to a point where it's, yeah, what you're saying, like it just doesn't make sense how it got to that point, but it's at that point. So, yeah.
I mean, yeah, especially the wife, you know, who's like almost in tears the whole time. I don't think she's actually crying, but like if I were to translate to, like I said, the closest thing I know, if it was a David Lynch movie, we'd have close up of the people on the table, like doing that thing that happens in Mulholland Drive with the old people where they're just kind of like, ah, you know, but everyone at the table is treating it like everything's normal. You know, we're just having a good time. I'm like, what is going on?
Scott, you're saying something?
Well, yeah. So like you have, Harry just influences everybody around him in the worst possible ways. So while this gentleman should be getting ready for the birth of his newest kid, he just gets angrier and angrier about how his family views him and how his wife views him and how his brother talks to him. And you really see this, and then his brother totally is hip to Harry's stuff. He's not with it. He's not understanding. When he decides to have a fish fry, he's frustrated. He makes himself very comfortable in this house, and it's just interesting to see him try to tear the family apart, but in the end, his coming really makes everybody come together.
Yeah. Which,
that's not like the, yeah.
Although, you compare it to Daughters After Dusk earlier, and Daughters After Dusk ends in the opposite way, where that's the last time the family will ever be together, like that. But in this movie, like, the family is pulled apart, but then they are brought together. So it's like an inverse of Daughters After Dusk in that way.
Oh yeah, totally. Where yeah, you see this family is just really getting back to wanting to get somewhere, and that made, yeah, it's just, I like films that try to, I don't know, I like family. I like when family is loving to each other, when family is safe, when it does work, you know. Some family isn't always the best, you know, but yeah. When it does work, when you see all these people that really do love each other, you know, and have just been falling apart, and then through their love and, spoiler alert, the death of Harry, they all get back together, you know?
Yeah. And like when a movie started before, like, cause I had no clue what to expect, and as it was going on, I was thinking, like, is he a serial killer? Because, like, immediately, like,
I thought that, yeah.
Like, the first appearance of him is his shadow, and, like, he's very cordial, but then in an instant, once he sees a broom, everything changes, and it's like, what's happening? Is he a demon? Is he a, like, it goes to, like, this. So immediately, you know, something is up with this guy, and like one part of mystery is you never know what is besides like the whole supernatural versus reality, like no hard hints going one or the other. It's just this weird guy who, you know, who shakes everything up.
That little kid is Harry's antagonist in the movie. Like, there's a bunch of times, you know, obviously the first time with the broom where you, like, never hit a person with a broom. It's bad luck, you know, and spits on the end of it and throws something over his shoulder. There's also a couple of scenes where he's doing something in the house where Like, you can see some other person being not happy with him getting away with whatever he's doing, or, you know, a couple of times where he's, like, searching through the house whenever he gets left in there alone. You'll see the little kid there, and he'll, like, walk the other direction. There's something about the innocence of this boy that is, like, works against his, whatever his juju is.
And there's a scene later with the broom where he's sweeping upstairs, and Harry is, like, terrified to go into the hall while he's sweeping, which just adds to, like, the weird, like, supernatural, borderline supernatural elements of, like, is he, like, scared of brooms? Is that his weakness? Like, what's going on here?
Well, I think like, in folklore tradition, brooms have some sort of illusion. I don't know much about it. I do know that when I went to Marcus's wedding, they jumped the broom when they got married. So the broom was part of their tradition. And I didn't ask too much about it because they were just having a good time getting married.
Hmm. Yeah, I've heard the jumping the broom thing before. I wonder if it's, I mean, it's just like one of those things like, you know, you're not supposed to throw your hat on a bed when you come into a room. That's bad luck. And I think it almost makes sense to me, the idea of like touching someone with a broom is bad luck, because it's like, what do you do with that end of the broom? You sweep trash, you sweep, you know, debris. So is this person debris? Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Joel, I'm curious about your thoughts on this. Do you think Harry could count as like a psychic vampire, like in a Stephen King type of way?
He is definitely, I mean, the way he is weirdly influential over the men specifically, it seems like he doesn't really have that much ability when it comes to women. But almost any man he was talking to was, you know, charmed and swayed and things like that. And like the fact that what is the name of the patriarch again?
Gideon.
Gideon. Yeah, I can't. It just won't stay in my brain. So Gideon getting sick like that does feel vampiric. Like he's spending so much more time with Harry, and they're walking around talking about the old times and things like that. It's, and when Gideon does go down, you know, his bedridden, Harry almost has like this new, you know, vivaciousness to his life. You know, that's when he starts having his chums around all the time. That's when he starts working on the younger son and stuff like that. Like nobody's challenging him.
I just thought of
another little kid thing I just want to mention real quick. Sorry. There also that part where he's talking about losing his Toby and replacing it with a rabbit's foot. He did not want that kid to touch the rabbit's foot. Sorry. What were you going to say, Scott?
No, I don't quite remember, but it wasn't that important, I promise you. Now I remember. Even I like him pushing them to do a fish fry. They're all like, they all sort of don't really want to do it. It seems like a big to do, but he's able to get everyone to do what he wants. And it's just, it's so interesting in how he does it. And then he's like, you know, he's like, I don't know. It's interesting.
I want to know what it was like before, or, you know, back in the day when they were all younger. And, there's that woman that does, he is like totally creepy and gross to the whole time. And for some reason, everybody's like, oh, Harry, you're just so nice touching her face when she obviously is creeped out. Like, obviously, something must have gone between them beforehand. And now, or she was saying she was a changed woman. So I knew this backstory.
Born again. She's a born again Christian, and they had a thing back in the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
like, I feel like if Harry killed somebody in the back of a train car or something, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, because they kept bringing up the whole thing about like Henry and his boys, and something like they were killed, and the one family friend hit Harry on it, and before Harry can give like any indication, he gets interrupted, and so it's this through line of like, did he kill like two or three people back in the day, or?
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Yeah, and it's, and that guy who doesn't like Henry that keep showing up. He looks like Isaiah Whitlock Jr. a little bit. Like if this were made now, that totally would have been Isaiah Whitlock Jr. Although I don't think he would have gotten his patented pronunciation in, because that might have been a little too much.
Well, yeah, I mean, nobody would even try.
In this scenario, it'd be a little silly.
And also, yeah, I really like how multifaceted and interesting the women characters are as well. They're not one dimensional. They all have different outlooks, and they're struggling. Or there's this great scene where Gideon Jr. is talking smack about Samuel in front of their kid, and the wife is like, don't do that, you don't talk smack about someone's parent in front of the kids, you know. And I just like those little niblets, because I remember being reprimanded kindly as a young person, you know, not to be careful who you admonish, and also to be mindful of admonishing someone in front of other people, to try to teach people lessons, but not embarrass them, not instill shame, if you will.
Yeah, and like the matriarch Susie, I love that she,
yeah,
she and the other woman, the one that Harry had a thing with, like those were like the main two that like saw through what he was doing, and they were probably the strongest.
Hattie,
and they are the strongest characters the whole time. And like,
yeah,
and like going back to the beginning with like how everything's layered. The first scene of Susie is her doing a Lamaze class, talking about breathing and relaxing, yeah. And she is the most, and she like is the most relaxed character, even though you can tell she's stressed, but she's trying to not give Harry what he wants, and she's successful and never like freaking out too much around Harry or making a big show of things. Like
Harry eventually broke Hattie though during the party, yeah, where they have the corn whiskey. You know, he makes some big thing about her. Oh, she could sing. She used to sing back in the day. And she's like, I'm not that person anymore. And then a few scenes later, she gets up and sings wonderfully. But
then the next time you see her, she's back to where she was before.
Right. I think that was just like the rated PG version of some Roman orgy. Like, it's people were singing and drinking corn liquor. Ah!
Yeah. And
well, sometimes, you know, you have to be reminded of your old life for a second, and then you go back to it. Like, yeah.
And like,
I would never go back to robbing banks, but you know, I could talk the business. It's just like, yeah. Wait, is this being recorded?
Yes.
Oh no.
Yeah, and like one of the things I loved, many things I loved about this was just like the chicken metaphor that I mentioned earlier of like showing like the chickens in the beginning are being contained and they're safe and like taken care of, and at the end they're not, with like the door open and a door shut in a chicken coop, and then after
Fox is in the hen house, right?
Yeah, and then uh-huh. After Harry shows up and Gideon gets sick, like either I think a chicken dies or there's something happens to the chicken that's like a clear like indication of like representing a family of like the chicken dies or like he cooks it, but something like that happens and it's like okay,
Him and his friends are getting ready, like one of his friend who looks much less mobile than him is running around trying to catch a chicken while Harry's talking to that other guy, and then they get ready to axe it. Like, I thought, Spencer, did you just trick me into another animal death movie? Because I'm going to be pissed. But, you know, the chicken gets away somehow.
I was worried, too, for a second. I'm like, how far is this going to go? There, I mean, there's a lot, but at the same time, I kind of don't want to go too much into this. So, like, if people listening who haven't heard it, haven't seen the movie, will... I don't know. Do you think this can be spoiled, this movie?
No. Because... You know, I'm definitely been guilty of not being sure about something and reading a Wikipedia synopsis and still been able to completely enjoy the movie because, you know, movies and art are so much more than just the story. It's about the tempo and the lyricism and the flavor and the pacing. And even though there were some mild spoilers about the movie, I still think you could totally, totally enjoy it. The polarizing Armin White said that, you know, the movie's interesting because the anything can happen quality gives it like this rare unexpected tone of psychic suspense, and that it's one of the most subtle, intense American movies that he had seen when it came out. Because before Armin White became so contrarian that you can sort of predict what movies he's going to like, he was a real champion for black film in this, and he would say that he still is, but he's an interesting guy.
We're not going to talk about him. I have complex opinions about him. I think as most people do.
Yeah, I know. I don't. How many people are just like, yeah, I like everything that guy says.
I know one person, but.
I know exactly who you're talking about.
Oh, are you going to cut out what I think he's a brilliant writer who got too into this one role of being so reactionary that I wonder how much he really enjoys things. But when I go back and read his criticism up until like the year 2000, and occasionally he'll write something that I really like, his thoughts about Prince and Michael Jackson and film were so well thought out, and he was very, very inspired by Hannah Arendt, and he was just he knows his shit, which is why it's frustrating when he'll say that, you know, Dragged Across Concrete was the movie that The Irishman wished it was, you know. You're just like, okay, dude. All right. You know, he wrote a review about Jojo Rabbit that encapsulated everything that frustrated me about that movie. But, you know, Ben Hall, you know, it's few and far between these days. So that's my statement about it. Sorry for bringing it up, guys.
No, don't worry about it. It's fine. But one of the old friends in this movie is Julius Harris. He's the bald one with the cane, and he was in he is in Nothing But a Man playing the dad, and he is in Live and Let Die as the henchman, and he's
from, okay,
and he's in Taking a Pelham 1-2-3 as a cop.
Which one?
Original. I think he is dead by the time the remake happened.
Okay.
But I love Julius Harris. He has a very recognizable face, and I'd never seen anything. This is like the newest thing I've seen him in, because I think he kind of slowed down. And anyway, I just want to bring up Julius Harris. Oh, he's also in Friday Foster, which we talked about in the Pan Greer episode.
And He's in Dark Man and, oh, Prayer of the Roller Boys, which is a super weird movie that Marcus made me buy a DVD of when we went to a movie convention. And it's, you know, Corey Haim plays a inline skater who's fighting neo-Nazis in the near future Los Angeles.
What? Wow.
So Prayer of the Roller Boys, it's a 1990, the same year as this, is a near future science fiction film where Corey Haim is really into rollerblading and he fights Nazis, if I remember correctly.
Oh, wow. That sounds like something
prescient.
Yeah.
I don't know what you guys, like, if you guys enjoy movies that are sort of disasters.
We only like good movies, like She Hate Me.
Well, I'm not saying movie. I'm being careful with my words. Like, I don't believe in the whole. It's so bad. It's good. Like, if you like it, it's good. But this one, it's if you like fun. Mm-hmm. If when I said, hey, do you want to see this 1990 indie sci-fi film where Corey Haim and Patricia Arquette play rollerbladers fighting neo-Nazis? If your response is like, oh, that sounds awesome, then it will be.
Yeah, it sounds... I'm no one to judge. I'm currently going through the Black Cobra series that Fred Williamson did.
Okay.
They're these really, really cheap Italian Dirty Harry knockoffs. Well, Dirty Harry and Death with knockoffs with Fred Williamson. And they are... I mean, they aren't good, technically, but if you like Fred Williamson in Italian knockoff cinema, you will love these movies.
I own all three on a disc with 15 movies that I got for a dollar.
There's a fourth one called Detective Malone.
Whoa! And is that a prayer for the Roller Boys or Prayer of the Roller Boys?
Yeah.
Prayer of the Roller Boys. He was also in Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man and Maniac Cop 3.
Mm.
Yeah, he's all over
Maniac place. Kate. anyway, I was going to say that would have been perfect for Please Don't Send Me in Outer Space, but if that comes back, I'll put it on the list.
Someone had to go have a baby and be a parent.
Yeah, he's pretty selfish. You don't have to cut this part out.
Aaron, if you're listening, your baby's adorable. I hope everything's going well with you.
Aaron, if you're listening, your baby's okay.
Aaron, if you're listening, congratulations on all these positive life events. Keep on doing what you're doing, and never regret being kind. That's what I tell everybody. But also, what frustrates me, To Sleep With Anger, you know, it had a restoration like 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And did a small theater run, and then this awesome Criterion collection, but it's not on the Criterion Channel, which is frustrating.
Yeah,
it was last month. Or
none of his movies are on. None of his movies are on the Criterion Channel right now.
Yeah,
which is really frustrating, because any American director should be on the Criterion Channel. Also because the Criterion Collection Channel is so good that sometimes I'll randomly pick a movie and watch it, and it's usually at least a 3 out of 5, which works for me.
Yeah, I don't know. The Criterion Channel is a little more picky than Filmstruck. Seems to be. At least there's a cartoon.
Filmstruck was dope.
Yeah.
Filmstruck was dope. I'm right now, my partner just introduced me to Turner Classic Movies.
Oh yeah, that has an app, right?
And it might. We just watch on the TV now that we're quarantined, you know. Mm-hmm. We every Saturday Saturday night, we just watch what they have, and they've been doing Pete Bogdanovich movies recently, so we watched Paper Moon and the Last Picture Show and What's Up, Doc, and they hold up.
I don't have cable, so I'm stuck with Tubi, which I'm okay with.
Tubi's not bad.
Yeah, it really depends on what is available, but they have everything. It's kind of amazing and annoying at the same time.
Yeah, a lot. There's like those websites that tell you where things are streaming, and a lot of things that I was looking for I found on Tubi, which was pretty sweet. But, you know, To Sleep With Anger is a near-perfect movie, and I want more people to see it, which would be a little bit easier if it was streaming for free, but it is also streaming for $3 or $4 on most streaming platforms, or you can buy a DVD on eBay if you're comfortable ordering things right now.
Some of the stuff like directly reminds me of my own family. There's the scene where which wife was it? It's the wife of the younger of the younger brother doesn't want to get out of the car and spend time with her in-laws. And my dad told me growing up he had an uncle Thad who would never go into the house whenever they'd visit. His wife and kids would go into the house, but he'd just sit in the car, and like they'd see him at church sometimes, but like that's the only time they'd ever speak. And there's some other family members I won't go into detail, but I'll leave it at
that. And that's what I right, and that's what I liked as well, because it reminded me of my family and those sort and like people that were struggling with different levels of assimilation and accommodation in their culture. So I had like very orthodox cousins who wouldn't come to the house, and then I had very modern cousins who wouldn't go to the orthodox house. And they would only talk in synagogue. So there are by telling your own personal stories and trying to tell it your own way, you can actually create a way for other people that are outside of those groups to connect.
Just like the southern stuff, because like my dad's from West Virginia, and so like a lot of the greens and the fried chicken and. Like, not to be stereotypical, but, like, the southern food, it, like, there's a reason it's so popular. It tastes great. And watching, like, all the dinner scenes in this movie made me very hungry.
Same. I watched it again this week, and, you know, I haven't eaten very big meals in a while, so that was interesting.
I was just South L.A. I don't, you know, not... We get food like that all the time.
Do you like greens and like chitlins and cornbread and stuff like that?
Maybe you'll be mad at me, but I have honestly never had most of those things. I've had cornbread, obviously, but never specifically greens. Never. What was the other thing you said?
Chitlins.
Chipland? No, I'm just kidding. No, I've never had chitlins.
Chitlins.
You would know about the smell. It has a very distinct smell.
Chitlins, that sounds unappetizing.
Pig intestines.
Or cow intestines. Grit? Oh, no, that sounds wonderful. I mean, manoodle, come on.
It's great, but...
It's really all about preparation with a lot of these stranger body part meats that people were given to cook with, you know?
Yeah, and that goes back to slavery and... Yeah, you know, there's like, that's another like deep connection that the movie has with like American history, and it's like and black families and like black history, but like even the food, which is like another brilliant detail. Well, not detail, but like I don't know.
And also, if y'all either of you ever seen the Hal Ashby film The Landlord?
Yes, I love that movie.
Well, there's that scene when Bo Bridges' mother goes to his house in Park Slope that he's gentrifying, and one of the tenants gives her greens and then has her drink the pan liquid, and she says this will put some lead in your pencil, and I've always really liked that.
That's a maybe episode to Landlord, because Bill Gunn co-wrote it. Well, he wrote it, and
yep.
Hal Ashby.
Bill Gunn wrote it.
Yeah.
He wrote it, and, you know, Personal Problems is possibly a top 10 movie for me.
I love Personal Problems, but I don't know if I could even talk about that movie.
It would be difficult. Yeah. It would be difficult. And Ganja and Hess, obviously. All right. Did you guys do The Sweet Blood of Jesus?
Yes, with your co-host.
Oh, yeah. I remember being like, why didn't you guys have me on there? And then I was like, let me stop complaining, because that doesn't help anybody. And I've been meaning to listen to the episode, because I think we're a rare few people who like that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's deserves more love. It's my favorite Spike Bamboozled.
Yeah, that's probably accurate for me. It's a really good movie. And I feel like it got panned for no reason.
I mean, it got panned for a lot of people comparing it directly to Ganja and Hess. And that's a hard thing to stand up to no matter what.
And also, like, based off Letterboxd, I feel like a lot of people don't know Ganja and Hess, because a lot of reactors are like, this movie's weird, I don't understand. So I also think that's just remaking a movie like that is just also gonna just like be even more divisive.
But, yeah, and he was weird about like that it was a remake of the movie and stuff. So I get it, but I think a lot of people that were not into it didn't see the movie. It's one of those movies where I feel that people just were like, I don't like it. But I'm like, did you see it? Because the whole not vampire genre is awesome.
Oh, yeah. So when we're done recording, we can talk about that a little bit, actually. A hint for upcoming.
I'll also send you an episode that we did about that. Because we both love Claire Denis, and Trouble Every Day is also an excellent, you know, non-vampire movie, or that Jim Jarmusch. What, you know, it's endless. It's a good time.
Yeah, and The Transfiguration.
You're from.
It's another one.
Yeah, and you're from West Virginia?
My dad's from West Virginia.
Oh, you're not from West Virginia?
No.
Because
I was born in Texas, military family. We end up in Delaware.
Oh, well, off record, I will tell you about the insane 3 months that I spent in Newark.
Oh, you said it right.
Well, yeah, because so in New Jersey, it's Newark. And in Delaware, it's Newark.
Yes, and a lot of people get that wrong. It drives me crazy.
Well, as someone who lived there for two months, 3 months, I don't know. It's definitely not a record story, but I'll tell you all about it one day.
Okay. All right. So I feel like we're basically done with To Sleep With Anger. It's basically watch this movie, watch Charles Burnett movies, buy the Blu-ray off of from Criterion, so Criterion knows that people want to watch more of his movies. Maybe they can do more of his movies, or release more, you know, like smaller black movies or African movies, because Criterion's great, but there are some big gaps in their library.
Oh, totally, totally. And that would be, yeah, like keep Charles Burnett on there. We want it.
May I say that I feel the same way about Atlantics, where I think, like you, as somebody who listens to the podcast, I would tell the listener, you have to watch that. I feel exactly the same way about this movie. Listener, if for some reason you listen to this entire episode and you haven't watched the movie, go rent it like I did, because it is worth it. Even if you walk away from it not liking it, I think that you will be better for having a better film watcher, a better movie lover, just for having experienced it.
Yeah, and also watch Atlantix. That movie's so good.
Exactly, that also.
And as of now, it's still on Netflix streaming, and the Criterion will come out later this year, so who knows if it'll still be on Netflix. Probably not. So watch it while you right. still can.
I mean, also, like, what a first film. I mean, you know, she comes from a good lineage. You know, her uncle did Tuki Buki, which I think is also on the Criterion Collection. So, yeah, Atlantix, that was one of my favorite movies last year.
It's great. And Tuki Buki is great. But also, if you haven't seen it, there's graphic animal death on screen.
There is. That's something I always tell people. Like, you know, a lot of foreign movies, they actually killed animals often.
But Tuki Buki, I think I tolerate that more because it's not like a cheapy like cannibal movie. It's thematic and
right.
it serves a purpose. Where like Cannibal Holocaust is just like they're defenders, but I think the movie is indefensible for all the wrong reasons.
I hear that.
Joel, you and me are not going to recommend other 1990 movies.
Oh, you're talking. You weren't asking me a question. You were just saying my name.
That we're gonna not recommend other 1990 movies because we have another thing, because pretty soon we're gonna actually do that recommend those. So instead, Scott has like one or two, and then that'll be it.
Well, yeah. I was just saying that. Well, no, because I don't remember if you're having me on for the Mo Better Blues one, but. I'd rather talk about these in connection to those because they make a little more thematic sense.
All right.
Aside from Predator 2, and you know, because me and Martin Kessler love that movie, and that movie's getting a lot of love retroactively.
Thank you so much
for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a long time coming.
It's a real pleasure.
And don't hate me, people listening, but I like Predator 2 more than Predator 1. It has a crazy...
it's a better movie. it's a better movie.
It has a crazy coked-up energy to it, where Predator 1 is more of an 80s... I mean, it's commentary on 80s action movies, but 2 is just like a crazy coked-up weird movie, and I kind of love it for... This like being so bold and strange compared to their first one.
Yeah, I liked it.
Anyway, so J-Dog, this will come out mid to late May. So
yeah,
what? Anything?
I mean, you could tell them now. I mean, we'll probably have an episode out by now.
Are you sure?
Sure. If you want to hear Spencer, me, and our other co-host Sarah. Talk about vampires. Vampires. Why would you talk about vampires? I don't know. We came up with this a couple of months ago, and then we actually started recording things, and that's what we talk about on the Dead Travel Fast podcast. Right now we're reading chapter by chapter through Dracula, each episode a new chapter. But at the end of the episode, we talk about a vampire movie, and we're going to be going with some themes rather than like by year or something else like that. We're still really in the like staging parts. We have put down two episodes at this point and a third one very soon. But it's still fresh.
That's so exciting. Yeah. I love to hear, I really like you guys' tone, so I'd like to hear you guys talk about vampire movies.
Yeah, and you have an open invitation for
absolutely.
We're still trying to figure out themes and all that stuff as of right now.
Yeah, it takes a little while. Our podcast, Zebras in America, we have over 120 episodes now, and we still don't know what the fuck we're doing. But we like it.
Zebras is great. I highly recommend Zebras in America. I haven't written in a while, but I used to write in semi-regularly. I probably might get back on that soon.
Please do. I enjoy your letters. You ask great questions that open up good discourse. And, I got to go get ready to do some notes for our next episode, which will probably have come out already. We're about to discuss the new Eliza Hittman movie. Never, rarely, sometimes, always.
Sorry, I just noticed my cat. I didn't know she was around. I thought she was... Never mind. I didn't know she was in the room with me. By the time this comes out, I might have an actor profile thing on my site, Jailhouse701 Japanese Cult Cinema. I'm still trying to figure out some stuff to... there's some gray area stuff in this one that I'm trying to figure out how to approach exactly. So it might not be up. And I might have a couple of reviews up by now, potentially. And, that's it for that side of things.
Sounds awesome.
All right. And thank you for coming on. And see you guys for... Wait, May. So that's going to be Amor, Hanukkah movie?
Michael Haneke, Hanukkah, yeah.
Yeah, whichever. My brain says Haneke, but he says a Hanukkah. Or it'll be Red Hook Summer. I'm not sure which one. And see you guys for that.
All right. Take care.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell. And thank you for listening.